The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, what can evolutionary psychology tell us about leadership?
Hunting, engaging in warfare, managing resources, internal peacekeeping, and individuals who tick those boxes are more likely to emerge as leaders and will be more successful as leaders.
Plus, it looks like the future's here, today. Robonauts are heading into space.
So you can replace an arm, you can replace a hand, you can replace a limb, you can replace a head.
And forget video calls, prepare yourself for holographic communications.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
But first, we strap four victims into NATO gas masks, adapted with Wi-Fi and 3D lenses.
The graph lines on the computer screen are actually going sort of almost sinusoidally up and down. But then as I start to hyperventilate...
We're testing the effects of panic, fear and arousal on cinema-goers.
The kind of physiological signs that the body gives off when they're subjected to highly emotive psychological experiences.
This is a frightfully stimulating edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian.
I'm Dr. Brendan Dare, I'm the consultant psychophysiologist at Thrill Laboratory. We're outside Broadway Cinema in Nottingham at the Mayhem Horror Film Festival. We're here to conduct tests to look at the effects of fear, panic and horror on the human respiratory system. And I'll show you behind stage where we're actually setting up the experiments now, show you some of the kit.
We have a screening in about an hour's time. We've just been laying out the equipment. We've got four subjects lined up who we're going to be experimenting on. And we have various bits of kit laid out on the tables. We have cameras they're going to be wearing around their necks, which are going to be looking back onto their faces. But the most important piece of equipment we have is a gas mask. So the gas masks have been specially adapted with 3D lenses so that our subjects can immerse themselves in the 3D experience of Piranha 3D, which is a blood, gore, and sexually arousing film.
Oh my god. This is the longest one I've ever seen.
They look a little bit like something out of Star Wars, but they're absolutely fit for the job of monitoring respiration. So I'm going to put the mask on now so you can just see what it looks like.
As I'm putting it on, you can see it obviously creates a very tight seal around my face, which is obviously very important for me to be able to monitor people's respiration rates. And I've actually adapted the size of these ports so that the filters have been taken off, and so we can measure quite accurately the pressure rise and fall inside the gas mask, which is directly correlated to my lung capacity as I'm breathing in and out.
So as I'm breathing deeply, you can see the graph lines on the computer screen are actually going sort of almost sinusoidally up and down. But then as I start to hyperventilate, they're going much shallower. So you can actually see visually the breathing rates and hopefully get an idea of the kind of emotional experience that our subjects are experiencing inside the auditorium at the same time.
God, they do mist up very quickly.
So we're really interested in how an audience in the bar is going to be engaging with the physiological data screened on the walls. So it's really a question of empathy. Are the audience members here going to be feeling any kind of emotional empathy with the subjects in the auditorium? So is panic infectious? If you see somebody hyperventilating, does that actually make you feel a little bit anxious? I don't know. I mean, that's a big question for us. So we're going to be interviewing people in the bar to gauge those kind of reactions.
VGA is plugged in, so whenever...
We're just laying out and setting up the equipment, calibrating it before our subjects arrive in the auditorium, getting the video cameras working, making sure the respirators are switched on and logging on to the network so they're sending the breathing data. And once we get the subjects in about 15 minutes, we'll start kitting them up with the equipment.
So, first of all, is that feeling airtight?
Yeah.
Feeling sufficiently science fiction?
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing I would do is I would attach the respirator to you.
My name is Sarah. As far as I understand, my breathing is going to be monitored throughout the film. Some kind of experimental thing. I haven't seen the film. I missed it when it was on in the cinema. So I've been very excited about seeing it. I've heard amazing things about it. All my friends have said that it's the sort of film that I would really love. I love the adrenaline, really. I like to be scared.
I'm going to be recording some of you. Are you a screamer? Do you make a lot of noise?
I don't tend to, no.
Heavy breather, then?
Perhaps.
Just tell me what that feels like.
Feels a bit claustrophobic.
We hope that will add to the horror experience.
Yeah.
This is what's going to be monitoring your breathing during the... And we should see in a moment, I'll tell you when, you'll come live.
Oh, yes, because I can see Sarah already, yeah.
Sarah's come live.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. That's your drinking straw, so you can dip that into your drink.
You can drink, but always remember to switch it off. You might have a nasty accident inside the mask. I don't want you to drown in there. Okay.
If you do start to drown, take the mask off.
Okay.
Right, I'm now going to attach the respirator. So the mask's going to get quite a lot heavier now. It's appearing there.
God. Okay.
It's incredibly erratic.
Erotic, did you say?
Well, yeah.
I can't see much of the screen. The mask is a little bit uncomfortable. I'm trying to slow my breathing down, but it's not really working. Well, it looks quite erratic at the moment. I'm trying to calm down.
I hope you enjoy the film. We'll stick around for a drink afterwards, and I hope these four at the front don't collapse or anything. So, enjoy the film. Thanks.
In the bar watching the subjects' reactions and breathing on the screen. So what have you been seeing from up here?
The breathing has been going off the scale in particular with one of the subjects, so we can see really when he gets a fright. Every so often we get these fantastic spikes of the breathing and jumps from the videos.
Oh my god. Here we go. Check it out. It's like fish with boobies.
What have you seen so far?
I say at the moments when the film directors are obviously engineering moments of tension, which ends in some pretty horrific scenes, really seeing very marked, erratic breathing patterns, very deep but very quick breathing patterns, and it's far more dramatic than I've seen any variation in heart rate before. I mean, it's quite fantastic.
This is so hot. This is what it's all about. Beer, sun, and naked honeys making out underwater. Boom! You've been to Sandra.
Any difference between the erotic scenes and the scary scenes?
It's actually quite funny. I'm finding that Sarah's breathing rates are changing. I think it's possibly because she might be feeling a little uncomfortable. This is only my supposition, of course. But then obviously Gareth and Chris, depending who the woman is, you'll see them start to breathe a lot faster as well.
You can find out more about all of that at thethrilllaboratory.com. There's a link to that on our Facebook group as well. Just look for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast.
Science Weekly.
Right, back to the studio now. We've got Nell Bowes, Ian Sample and Robin McKee in with us. It's show and tell time. We're going to start off with you, Ian. This is about improving your maths knowledge, but it's nothing to do with learning times tables.
No, this is a study from a group at Oxford University and UCL, University College London, where they used a technique called transcranial direct current stimulation, which essentially passes a low current through your head, through your brain, to try and stimulate certain areas. And,
it isn't the first thing you'd think of. I mean, I know that some people worry about their maths ability, but electrocuting your head isn't sort of what people think is a good idea.
No, absolutely. I'm totally with you on that. And it doesn't hurt, but apparently you do feel a bit of a tingling sensation when this thing's going on for about 15 to 30 seconds. And but no, I mean, they did it on... It's a small bunch of people that these guys have done the study on. Basically three groups of five students that they gave different kinds of stimulation to. But one of the groups certainly fared a lot better at this kind of really interesting new mathematical skill that they were trying to learn over a week. And it was basically they were learning to manipulate numbers that didn't look like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They had a whole new symbols that were completely foreign to them. So it was as if you were learning about numbers as a kid from scratch, because you just have these symbols and you have to assign to those symbols different sort of numerical values.
So what was the sort of abilities of these people afterwards? Were they just much far better? Was it sort of within the margin of error? Why is this interesting?
So they did a couple of tests on them. I mean, one of them was after each day of going through these tests and having their brains zapped or not zapped, depending on the study, they would have to arrange the symbols along a line according to from the lowest on the left to the highest on the right, and see how good they were at doing that kind of thing and whether they actually did them linearly. Because you find what happens with if you don't know your numbers very well, you actually put them down in a kind of according to a log scale, which I didn't know. And then there was another test where you had to, you know, there's a study where you can read colors in a list and it'll say red, green, blue, but every now and again you write the word blue in like green or something like that.
The Stroop test, I think it's
called. Yeah, so there's that test. You can do a similar thing with numbers where you can have a physically small number and a physically big number. But then numerical values are swapped around the other way. So you see what I mean? So a 4 might appear smaller than a 2. And the more you know your numbers, the more that confuses you. So if you're really comfortable with numbers, you go through and that will really mess with your head. But if you just see them as symbols with no other meaning, then you go through it like as a total breeze. People who are stimulated from the right to the left side of the brain, they sort of did as well as adults do with normal numbers. So people who are really familiar with numbers, they performed as well as that. Whereas if you had your brain stimulated the other way from left to right, you fared a lot worse. Your performance was worse, and it was also worse 6 months later.
Nell, you're a maths genius. Do you fancy a bit of electricity through your head?
Well, I'm wondering why. What's the mechanism behind it? What's the theory?
So there's been some studies in the past which show that the right parietal lobe, in particular, which is above the ear towards the back of the head, the right parietal lobe seems to be involved with learning maths and processing numbers. If you send a current from the right side to the left side, you stimulate that part of the brain more. And what you do is you make it easier for the nerves to fire in that part of the brain. If you send the current the other way, evidently you dampen it down or you excite the other side more, the left parietal lobe more. And that seems to actually impair people's learning ability. But giving it this extra boost improved their learning skills. And say that learning, their ability at sort of manipulating these sort of foreign numbers, if you like, they retained it for another 6 months.
I think it's a cheap shot to get an Ig Nobel, so you electrocute students to make them count. I think that's all they're going for.
Are you saying they're gaming the system? Would you, they showed that this was useful, would you have a go, Robin? You're probably great in maths anyway, but...
I was quite good at maths, but unfortunately, a lot of grey cells have died in the intervening decades.
Well, there you go.
And
this,
I think
this could
if
help.
You started electrocuting what I've got left, I'd be in deep shit.
All right, well, let's move on. This next story is an update, really, on some remarkable work going on to give blind people sight.
That's right. I mean, there have been a lot of stories in the press. We've all covered them. of people implanting retinal chips, which are essentially light-sensitive microchips into people's eyes. And the idea being that it's essentially like a digital camera, light falls on the light-sensitive elements, and then it stimulates what's left of your sort of the nerves at the back of your eye, the cells at the back of your eye, which then send a signal to the brain and you make up a picture. And this was some research out of the University of Tübingen in Germany, which was reporting the sort of the highest resolution chips that have been used so far.
I mean, how difficult is the operation? How could it become a fairly common treatment for people with these conditions? Or is this really kind of cutting edge and we're way beyond the day when it's commonplace?
It's not an easy operation because it takes about, at first anyway, the first few patients, it took about 6 or 7 hours. Mika, the guy I was talking to, had the operation done, said he came out of it looking like he'd been in a boxing ring, you know, heavily swollen around the left eye where he had it implanted. Yeah. You have to cut a little flap in the eye, and you put the chip in. The chip's only 3 millimeters on each side, but you have to put it behind the retina, which is obviously extremely delicate. So you have to lift the retina up, put it behind it. I mean, that is an operation you'd want someone who's just qualified as an eye surgeon to do. Yeah. It's incredibly specialist. And the operation now takes about 5 hours, so they've taken some time off it, but it's not commonplace at all.
What's happened to Mika? Has he still got the chip or not?
No. He was in the trial, which only gave the chips to these people for 3 months. And one of the reasons was that at that time you had to have a cable coming out of the chip, came out behind your ear onto a battery that you wore around your neck like a necklace. There's another study where they're taking this forward into multi-centre trial, which involves London and Oxford eye centres, as well as those in Germany and elsewhere, where the entire system is implantable. So the battery is implanted into your head as well, and you recharge it using a coil, which is really nice because then you can have the whole thing implanted permanently, provided that the chip is okay at the back of the eye. But, you know, these operations are done on people who are profoundly blind, so you aren't going to make anything worse.
Okay, let's move on to my favourite story of the week, which is holographic communication.
I saw part of the message you...
I seem to have found it.
General Kenobi, years ago you served my father in the Clone Wars. Now he begs you to help him in his struggle against the Empire. This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Yes, we had the Derriga pictures of Princess Leia all over the place.
They were the best ones to use, anyway. You explain.
So this is it's quite exciting. I think, Alok, you're more excited about it than I am. This is the ability
we'll be the
to
judge of that.
Beam a three-dimensional image over the internet, basically. So you've got your standard holograms invented last century. You've got the problem to date has been that when you create a holographic image, you're creating it in a material that you can't then change. And what this team in Arizona have done is to come up with a polymer that they can rewrite with holographic information, or these, what do they call them, hoggles instead of pixels. So they take an image, they film it with about 16 cameras or dozen cameras, merge that information in order to create these hoggles, which can then give you the ability to perceive light as it would have been emitted by the original object.
Is the polymer actually physically changing when they update the image?
So there are groups of different differently charged particles within the polymer, mm-hmm. and it's written by a sort of nanosecond laser that can move those charged areas around, and then you can rewrite every 2 seconds to create a different pattern that will diffract light or reflect light in order to see the image.
Is that going to be the limiting factor? Because what you obviously want is something that's updated in real time, like 50 times a second, 50 frames a second, like telly. I mean, can the material respond that quickly?
2 years ago, they were on the 4-minute window. Now they're down to 2 seconds, and they're aiming for 30 frames a second.
But you wonder if the material itself might have an inherent limitation on that, and that you just can't move this stuff around that fast.
Telepresence systems already use quite high definition video, and the idea is that you would incorporate this into your classic telepresence video. So what this will allow people to do is, if you're doing surgery from different parts of the world,
the idea of telesurgery is that you you can have someone with the expertise who can sort of bring their expertise to someone in a remote environment. But in this situation, you'd have to have your person with expertise who would have their polymer and their Hoggles in front of them. And then your patient, who would be presumably sort of lying in a gutter in the middle of Africa, would be surrounded by the most high-tech cameras in the world.
We don't have doctors,
and an enormously
200
you know,
cameras.
Yeah, which is deeply implausible. And it does just make me wonder what this really is for. I mean,
I do find the telepresence thing a little bit implausible, because you've got the museum, you've got the kind of 3D effect, sufficient to allow kind of interaction between human beings, particularly when you're not going to go up and walk around each other if you're sitting down at a table having a meeting. Basically, the Arizona team, the guy himself says that he saw Star Wars and he just thought, I want to do that.
Just for the record, by the way, it was in the paper itself, this the reference to Star Wars, right in the abstract. So if anyone complains that we've made this a reference up, then I'm afraid you have to go right back to the source. We'll wind up this news section with a bit on the space shuttle again. Robin, at the time of recording, well, it's Friday now, the space shuttle still hasn't gone up. Excitingly, though, there is actually a robot on board this space shuttle, which we didn't mention last week, called Robonaut 2.
Robonaut was designed to be a human assistant, just kind of the same way a nurse would be to a doctor in an operating room. So you can think of Robonaut as helping a human worker set up a work site, tear down a work site, hand him a tool, please hold this for a while. Robonaut's ability to utilize the same connectors, the same tools, and do the same sorts of tasks that the astronauts can do on the space station in a way to aid them.
Inevitably, it's R2, right? It's like a torso of a human torso. It's got no legs, and it's a robotic assistant. These things exist in all science fiction movies, and now they're going to have one on the space station. It's going to be hoovering things. It's going to be helping them carry heavy things. The astronauts, I mean. And if it works out really well, it'll.
It's going to be helping them carry heavy.
Yeah, that's what they say.
In free fall. Well, so give us a hand with that.
It takes a lot to get them going.
Let's get this one out. They will still have heavy objects. Will still have inertial mass.
They will have inertial mass. You're absolutely right.
What I mean by that is it'll help them carry difficult things. You know,
but it's bound to go wrong and start smuggling aliens on board, or it will start hijacking things, take over the space station, and crash land on Washington.
I think it probably runs on Windows, so it won't do.
Nobody likes it.
Let me finish. So what else it will do is it's a £1.6 million robot funded by GM, General Motors. I thought they were bankrupt. Anyway, funded by NASA and GM. And the idea is that if it works, then there can be more of these things eventually going off to Neptune and exploring and all of that. It sounds awesome. It's got four cameras in its head.
Ian looks crestfallen. He wants to go to Neptune.
Are we going to send a legless robot off to go explore some planet on its own?
I think if R2 demonstrates its usefulness, they're going to give it legs. They're going to develop legs.
The R2 will get legs.
This is like Edward Scissorhands in space, isn't it? They couldn't quite develop hands for it. So, you know,
four-eyed robot that's legless all the time. I mean, like,
and on that note, we'll wind up there. If you want more on any of this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Check levels. Can I please tell me what you had for breakfast, please?
I had a piece of toast and jam.
I had the same. Toast and jam.
Next in the podcast, we look at what evolutionary psychology can tell us about leadership.
Can I just check the pronunciations of your names, please?
In the studio with me are
Mark Van Vught
and
Anjana Ahuja.
They've just written a book called Selected: Why Some People Lead, Why Others Follow, and Why It Matters. So, Mark, does leadership simply evolve from humans needing to work in groups?
Well, essentially, yes. So what we argue in the book is that the history of leadership goes back millions and millions of years, even predating humans, because every social animal, an animal that has to stay with other animals together to do certain things, will have some sort of rudimentary form of leadership. You see it in the waggle dance of the honeybees. You see it in ants, you see it in birds, chimpanzees, etc. And what we've done is we've built upon those basic forms of leadership in humans to create these very complex societies where we now have one individual, say the president of the USA, leading millions of people through language primarily. Language is a main driver of the complexity of leadership in human societies today. But the building blocks, they date back millions of years ago.
I should say, I mean, I used to be a journalist for a national newspaper, and I came across leadership books by the dozen. And
you see them in airports all over the place,
all over the place, yeah. And I'm not a buyer of business books. But it was when I was a journalist that I came across Mark's work. And the thing about this particular book is that I think it kind of brings illumination to sort of things that have evaded explanation. So, for example, we look at the importance of height in the book, and it's, you know, it's one of those curious facts that people always say that, you know, tall people earn more, they're, you know, they tend to have more children. In the US presidential elections, the taller candidate usually wins, and it's kind of cited as a sort of, isn't it interesting? But actually, if you look at leadership through the prism of evolution and think about the kind of leaders that our ancestors would have favoured, then actually all these kind of disparate, interesting, curious things make sense. So in some ways, it's a way of understanding the world as it is today, even though, you know, when you think rationally, there's no reason why a tall person should be leading the free world. But it just so happens that those are the kind of leaders that press our psychological buttons.
Mark, on the savannah, what is the advantage of a tall person?
Well, there's various predictions which we're currently testing in our lab. One thing I need to stress is height is more important as a predictor of leadership in males than in females. There are various reasons why that might be the case. One, height might give you an advantage in a physical battle. Now, given that conflict between groups would have been prevalent on these savannas, fighting for the waterholes that were very few there, it would have given an advantage to follow a physically strong leader. The other hypothesis is that height might signal something like good health, good genes. And so you would want to follow a healthy leader, particularly in these grueling circumstances where you had to trek for miles and miles over the savannah to get somewhere. And the third hypothesis that we're looking at is, it sounds a bit odd, but height might give you a better vision over an environment. And so these individuals might be able to see more.
And how does this idea of leadership translate from our evolutionary history to, say, the modern boardroom? What, can you apply these things?
Yes, I mean, I think you can. You want to kind of take what's good, I suppose, about what we call natural leadership, but because we know, for example, we know that people are generally happier in small companies. Why is that? You know, it doesn't mean that you have to run all your companies as tiny little, you know, entities. But, you know, if you do run a large company, why not try and, you know, have breakout groups, have run them in units that kind of mirror the tribes that we would have lived in. The other important message is that even though an evolutionary kind of explanation explains what's going on, it doesn't excuse it. And in some ways, we're trying to bring to light some of the innate biases we have. So when you're, you know, if you're an interviewer and you're sitting in a room and you're confronted with, you know, a tall candidate, a short candidate, you know, women, men, people of different cultural backgrounds, it's worth sort of trying to step back and think about what is it about these candidates that's ticking the right buttons, and are you paying enough attention to the experience, and are you perhaps overlooking the woman unfairly? Are you overlooking, you know, the person who doesn't look like a leader, even though they might have a really good skill set? We know that there are studies that show that having women as directors of companies cuts a company's risk of bankruptcy. So even though many companies don't have any women on the board, there's actually good scientific business evidence from people. It was a study at Leeds University, actually, and they actually collated the statistics on bankruptcies and the gender makeup of boards. And if women are good at governance, and so even though women find it hard to get into that position, it really ill serves British business to not have them there.
One qualification of that is that we also have research which we report in the book that there is a niche for female leadership, particularly in situations in which peacekeeping or peacemaking are very important. I mean, it's not for nothing that the last few foreign secretaries in the US were women, Hillary Clinton, the current one. So there are certain qualities that we believe also in ancestral environments mattered, where women were more suited to occupy these leadership roles.
Well, I was going to just come to that, actually. Are there different types of leadership? I mean, one is, as you mentioned right at the beginning, say a warrior, a general in an army leading people into battle. That's a kind of the classic description of leadership. But leadership must do lots of other things too, like cooperation and things. I mean, are there different roles for different genders or different types of people as well who can become leaders in different ways?
Well, what we have done is based upon very minute research is identify six ancestral prototypes of leadership, which should still really be visible in people today. And some people may be more one category of leader and others might be another category of leader. So we've identified the warrior, the scout, that's the currently it would be the scientist or the entrepreneur,
explorers.
The individual, yes, the explorer, going around, gathering resources, finding new creative ideas. And that's a form of leadership in and of itself. And then we have the arbiter, which is essentially the peacekeeper. They smoothen the relationships within a group. And that's obviously very important for fostering cohesion in ancestral environments that would have been either life or death for a group. And it's still important today.
I wonder also what kinds of leaders people want. So do you have to be a good person?
Well, that's an interesting question because good leadership, by definition, doesn't mean moral leadership.
Meine deutsche Jugend, nach einem Jahr kann ich euch hier wieder begrüßen.
I mean, Hitler was by all terms and definitions a good leader because he attracted a lot of followers. And so what people are looking for is a individual that protects their interests and achieves their goals. But these goals of one group may not necessarily be the same as the goals of another group or another organization. So, for example, a warrior leader would be somebody who protects the interests of their own company, obviously at the cost sometimes of rival companies. But that's all right. That's what people would want to see. So, and that's sort of quite interesting because that also suggests that maybe sometimes employees would want to have a CEO or work for a CEO who shows off. Yes, because it looks good on the entire company. So it's a little bit more complex than just being moral, if you like, in a sort of universal way. We want them to be honest. We want them to show some humility as well. But first and foremost, they should protect our own interests.
What about when leadership goes wrong? Lots of ways that something can go wrong. I mean, if someone is good at what they do, they tend to be promoted, whether it's in public life or in companies, out of what they're good at and into sort of managerial or leadership-like roles, and they're awful at them. And we've all probably got our own examples of those. But then also there's things like corruption. I mean, leaders who misuse their power. I mean, how can you explain that from the sort of the standpoint you're taking in the book?
Well, what we argue, based on the evidence primarily from the anthropological literature, which looks at traditional societies and their forms of leadership, is that arguably we've evolved to live in quite egalitarian societies. There weren't a lot of goods to go around, not a lot of resources, and the resources that were there were distributed fairly equally among group members. That's not to say that there weren't any status differences, but not to the same extent as we see them today. Of course, there were individuals there who sometimes tried to dominate the rest of the group. But these societies have very effective mechanisms to deal with them. We call them stops, strategies to overcome the powerful. And they range from gossiping to assassination and anything in between.
What a spectrum that is.
So, and what we argue basically is that these stops, if they are not around in a particular company or a country, anything where leaders emerge, then it's more likely that those leaders will serve their own interest and do what is good for themselves rather than what is good for society or their organization. It's very interesting to see, which we also cite in the book, that one of the first things that aspiring dictators do when they come into leadership positions of a country is to control the media, because the media is the major source of gossip. It's the major source of ridicule, and it's really a what we call a leveling mechanism, or a stop to stop possible exploitative behaviors of leaders.
Let's finish by talking about something we touched on just before, which is this idea of the fact that we, I suppose, our brains are humans have evolved to live in small groups, and leaders will have evolved, I suppose, to run those small groups of people. But yet we live in huge cities of 10 million people. We work in huge companies, and you've got an interesting thing called the mismatch theory. Can you take us through that?
All right. Well, mismatch is essentially the idea that evolution, biological evolution, is a slow process. And if the environment changes very rapidly, as it has done in human society since the agricultural revolution, then basically it means that our capacities, our innate capacities, may not be adapted to function in those modern environments.
Yeah, given that evolution takes thousands of years to work, and we've
exactly
lived in these societies for only for a few hundred.
And so the consequences is that there might be a mismatch between the demands on current modern leadership and what we are capable, or what leaders are capable of offering nowadays. And so that shows itself, as we've discussed, in the preference for taller leaders. I mean, why would you want a tall leader if the leader is sitting in his office pressing some buttons? I mean, what's the point of that, really? It shows itself in all sorts of ways, our preference for in-group leaders rather than outside leaders. And what we basically should be trying to do is to work around the limitations set by our ancestral brains to create these large-scale societies. And we can really only do that is by using essentially the model of the small band communities. And so any large organization, any country, any community really consists of a lot of nested organizations, small groups that make up units within an organization, that make up departments, and that make up companies. And there you can have the sort of informal leadership that is was effective in ancestral societies, and really that makes current large organizations function.
One of the things I should say is that I think Mark's been very modest about his own work, because one of the things that struck me when sort of working together on Selected was that, I mean, you actually have run experiments, social group psychology experiments, where you can put really intelligent university students in groups to work together, and they will choose incompetent leaders. They will choose leaders that they already know have failed at the task that they're then going to perform. And it's really striking. I mean, it just shows that these innate biases are there, they're active, but they're working almost without our knowledge. And in this particular example of choosing an incompetent leader, groups tend to choose leaders who look like them. They're in tribe, and I think the distinguishing feature of the incompetent leader was that he belonged to the same university. And so we know that there are these inherent biases, and it's as well to be aware of them.
Hi, this is Maggie Philbin, and you're listening to the natural successor to Tomorrow's World, the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
That's it for another edition of the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. Thanks to everyone at the Broadway Cinema in Nottingham and the Thrill Laboratory people. And we hope the victims of the experiment aren't too traumatised. Not because they had to wear those ugly gas masks, but because they were forced to watch a truly awful movie. And this may not be your usual source for film reviews, but the pornificent Piranha 3D was life-wastingly awful. Take it from me. But that said, remember, check out more details about that experiment at thrilllaboratory.com. Thanks also to Nell Bowes, Ian Sample and Robin McKee, as well as our leadership experts
Anjana Ahuja
and Mark Van Vught.
On next week's podcast, we look at the threat climate change poses to our national and international security. Plus...
Hi, I'm Tim Radford. I used to be a science editor for The Guardian. I'm really looking forward to making an appearance on the podcast next week. I think that's all I have to say on that theme, but I now have to go and work out what I'm going to say on the podcast. Anyway, I do enjoy the programme. Bye.
And we visit an exhibition on mind-altering drugs.
Bing, 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 bing.
Oh, yes.
Hello, hello. Testing, testing, testing.
We've only got this chap on the programme.
I mean, I've heard it called a science show, which, I mean, if I had the elevator and all I had was 10 seconds, say it's kind of a science show, but it really isn't. It's sort of a science show for poets.
Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Follow this podcast on Twitter as well, @scienceweekly, and we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. To be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow @guardianscience. Science Weekly is presented by Alok Jar and produced by Andy Duckworth. Thanks for listening.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
So Ian, let's start with a story about how to improve your maths ability. And it isn't about learning times tables.
No, this... Sorry, I heard something then. Is it my... Is my
it's your voice.
The voices.
The voice.
So
when you speak... When you speak, you can hear yourself.
Start
usually.
That again. Start that again.
And this the sorry, that was a sudden stop.
Well, I thought I had
no, no, that's
shot.
Fine. That's exactly right. That's exactly
you know
right.
What Andy was saying.
No, it's exactly right. Result. He's pleased. He's pleased.
I've got marks.
I have a question prepared. I was just not really listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.